The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Alex Jackson. Alex is the founder of the restaurant Sardine and now the head chef at Noble Rot Soho. His new cookbook, Frontier, is available now. Alex, welcome to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Alex, we're going to start where we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
Well, there's a few bits and pieces that spring to mind. My grandma, on my mum's side, she was from Wales, and she was a head chef, actually, at one point in her career. She was a head chef in a hotel in mid Wales. It's a bit simpler than the food I cook in the restaurant where I work now. It's breakfasts, you know, trays of bacon. But when we went to her house, she used to cook chips, and that's what I remember. Because her house smelled of, like, toffees and cigarettes, faintly, and chip fat. It's a very comforting smell. I've given up cigarettes now, but sometimes I still make chips. But yeah, she used to make egg and chips for us. Other things that I don't really remember, sometimes some ham. But that one is a memory that I was talking about recently. And she was a fantastic cook. Nothing too fancy, but a lot of heart. It's nice.
And did she inspire in you a love of cooking?
Yeah, I mean, it was more my mum, really. My mum was the one who sort of bit more adventurous in her cooking. She's always been a good cook, but I think, you know, sort of era of like 90s dinner parties was my mum's domain. So she had like all the River Cafe books, the Quaglino's cookbook. And it was a bit of sort of London glam brought to a Birmingham suburb. But, you know, she was great. And, you know, I remember cooking with her and she, you know, she had the repertoire that she'd go through, like, you know, Monday's a stir fry to use up the stuff from the roast dinner. She used to cook a roast every Sunday for us. I don't know how she had the energy, really. I think she said it's because it's the only thing all of us liked. But I remember, like, chicken breast bashed out thin and a bit of flour and wrapped in parma ham and a wedge of lemon, skewered on a cocktail stick and fried. That was, I think, Thursdays.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, a lot of great stuff. But, yeah, it was my mum, really. And when I cook with my mum now, she gets all nervous, but it's silly. You know, she's still as good as a cook as she ever was.
And what were meal times like in your family?
Yeah, we all ate together, you know. It was fun. I'm one of three siblings. So, yeah, there's quite a lot of us, all the Gannets.
It's the roast.
It's the roast dinners, yeah. I remember, like, eating, like, Christmas dinners and me and my brother, like, polishing off, like, three piles of Christmas dinner. My dad, like, slowly counting the dwindling pile of roast potatoes. But, yeah, mealtimes were lovely, you know. It was a happy home and lots of food and eating together all the time. It was nice.
And what about at school? Was school food good or bad for you?
I don't really remember early memories. Apparently, I came home talking about these purple cubes that I'd eaten, which was beetroot, I think. I don't remember primary school. There was a weird memory of some, like, horrible ravioli. And then secondary school, I just ate, like, chips and stuff. I put on a lot of weight, I think. I was 13 and I said, I blamed it on sort of growing sort of puppy fat. But it's because I ate sort of a bowl of chips and a packet of peanut M&Ms every lunchtime. It's not a very healthy diet. So, yeah, school was not necessarily
I learned all this stuff. And am I right in thinking it was at university that you first really taught yourself to cook?
Yeah, that's right. I went off with, like, a Nigel Slater and Jamie Oliver book in my bag. And I was in self-catering halls. And most of my friends were in catered accommodation. I thought, how silly. You don't get to cook. And I remember sort of cooking in, like, this tiny hall's kitchen. And two of my friends who, like, still work in food now, Rebecca May Johnson, who is a published author, she wrote that really nice book, Small Fires. She would come over and we'd cook in the halls. We went to the same uni. And my friend Max, who smoked salmon until recently was smoking salmon in West Cork. Anyway, I remember us three all cooking in that kitchen together. And I was in halls for some reason, opposite Selfridges, which was where the halls was. And used to go to, like, the Tesco Metro at Marble Arch and do some cooking. But yeah, university was where it started. And then my year abroad in France, because I did a French degree, that was where it really continued. And we would do a lot of cooking. Well, you know, we didn't go to the lectures, so we had a lot of spare time. And when we weren't drinking, we did eating. And we lived, for some reason, in the 7th arrondissement, which is, you know, Ecole Militaire, Eiffel Tower. It's a very silly place to live if you're a student and don't have much money. But the market street, it's called Rue Clair, we used to go every day. And it was fantastic butchers, fromagerie and veg shops and this amazing deli called like Maison de Jambon or something. And with like hanging Italian hams and big jars of conserves. And when truffle season came, it had said in big letters, like, the white truffles from Italy have arrived. You know, it was very sort of well-to-do shopping street. Anyway, we hung out there and bought the cheapest stuff from the cheapest shops. But we still sort of felt part of it. And we went to the markets, you know, with the Eiffel Tower at the end of the boulevard, like that, you know, that picturesque, and would buy things and go and cook them. Not in my flat, in my friend's flat, it was much nicer.
And what were the main lessons of French cooking that you kind of took away at that point?
Oh, well, I'd learned to love cheese. Like, I didn't really like cheese before, but went to my friend's Max's flat, and he had sort of no less than 7 types of cheese at any one time. And we'd taste our way through and go to the cheese shops and start trying it. I ended up working in cheese for like a year and a half as well with Mons, who are based in Bermondsey. There was that, but also sort of that introduction to market cookery. Like, you go to the market, see a rabbit, buy a rabbit, cook the rabbit. Never cooked a rabbit before, doesn't matter. You know, that was it. We were going to cook lapin à la moutarde. We bought 2 types of mustard and we bought a whole rabbit and we cooked it in this tiny oven that we had. And, you know, cheap bottle of wine and you're away, really.
And how did it go? I mean, rabbit's quite a difficult thing to cook, isn't it?
I seem to remember it being delicious, yeah. That's beginner's luck, I think. But yeah, we did a lot of cooking and we ate out and a few times, like, we didn't eat anywhere fancy, but there were a couple of, like, very, very small bistros that we went to, which was, like, one cook in the corner of the room, kind of hands flailing around in a sort of meter square space. Really classic menu, and you could get a starter for €3 kind of thing, and a bottle of house wine for €15 or something. And that was our dining out experience. And it was so convivial, and they were so friendly, you know. It was so easy to go and eat there. And I'd never really had that before.
And did you work in any restaurants in France? Was that when you got back to London that you then started
No,
I
never cooked professionally before. I never worked anywhere, really. I'd worked in a cafe, like, I was, you know, get a bit of money for my gap year kind of thing. But, yeah, when I moved back to London, I started working in a cafe. And when I left there, I went to work with Stevie Pyle at Dot Kitchen. And I know Stevie from Birmingham, actually. We went to school together. And kind of fell in there. And they needed someone who could wait tables and make coffee. And that was me. And then kind of gravitated towards the kitchen.
Was there a moment where this interest in cooking and food and working front of house sort of crystallised into wanting a career as a chef?
Yeah.
Or did it come more gradually than that?
Well, it was quite gradual. It was over a period of 6 months, I think. So I started waiting tables, set up the restaurant. And I kind of come in early and set up the restaurant because once it was set up, there was cooking to do. Because, you know, for quite a long time, it was just Stevie in the kitchen. He'd come in late and, you know, he'd be like, oh, what should we put on the menu today? He'd need a hand, you know. So I would make myself available to do that because it's more fun than printing the menus off. And then I got to do more and more cooking. And eventually Stevie said, well, do you want to just be a chef instead? And there was a period where I was doing both. And at the time I was kind of thinking about going into teaching. I was like, oh, I'll do some work experience. Did you do a PGCE or something? But then I started cooking full time and I'd loved it. And I'd come back from work every day going, wow, this is what I got to cook today. This was on the menu. This exciting thing happened. And the first 6 months I found really difficult. Because I didn't know what I was doing. I made a lot of mistakes. But after 6 months, it kind of started to click. I felt more confident in the kitchen, sort of walking around without burning things or burning people or myself. And then, once it starts to click, I thought, well, you know, there's no going back, really.
And when did you decide you were wanting to open your own restaurant? What was the moment?
I don't think I ever really thought about it much before the opportunity presented itself. As a friend came to me and said, he'd been approached by a mutual friend, by someone, and she'd been employed by someone who owned an art gallery, and they wanted to move their offices upstairs and put a restaurant in, because they thought it'd be sort of a placemaking thing. And that was a parasol unit at the gallery, which is next to Victoria Mirror Gallery, and the restaurant became Sardine.
And tell us about it. What was kind of the concept behind Sardine?
Well, we kind of weren't sure what to do. Stevie helped me out with setting it up. And we were talking about what kind of restaurant it should be. And, you know, at Dot Kitchen, I'd been cooking lots of different things, and I worked for him at a different restaurant, cooked Italian. And I knew I wanted to cook Mediterranean food, which is sort of not an obvious choice, sort of the back streets of Hoxton, sort of behind a drive-through McDonald's on City Road. But that was it, and that was what I wanted to cook. Because I think when I was working for him before, I got the opportunity to write some set menus. And the books that I'd be reading at the time were all Provençal. There was, you know, Richard Olney's Lulu's Provençal Table, which is still one of my favourite books. And Leslie Forbes' A Table in Provence. I remember those two books and cobbling a menu together from a few books. And there were things that I'd never really cooked before, but things that I was interested in because I thought they felt exotic to me, sort of. Both, I knew them, but they also felt exotic. And so we kind of decided to hone in on cooking Provençal. And that's what Sardine became.
And had you spent much time in Provence at that stage?
No, not even. I've been a few times. But I used to go with my family to a different bit of the south of France, which at the time I was like, oh, it's the same. It's really not. The food's completely different. But we used to go sort of near Toulouse, Albi, Gaillac kind of area. So kind of, you know, southern French food I kind of had experience with from an earlier age. But Provençal was something that it really came from a love of books. You know, I read these books about Provence and I just thought it sounded so wonderful and the food sounded so interesting that I knew I wanted to know more about it. So, you know, I did a few trips before opening the restaurant and I read a lot of books and wrote a lot of menus, and then we were away.
And you also wrote a book called Sardine.
Yeah.
How do you go about writing food books? What's the process?
It takes me ages. I don't know. I've always just done it in my spare time. And, you know, I've always worked in restaurants. And at the time I was running a restaurant, I was working, you know, there's only two cooks in the kitchen most of the time. So, you know, I was working a full-time week and I'd do it in my spare time. You know, I had a young daughter at the time. I don't know really when I did it. I remember writing a few recipes as deadlines approached. It was a good motivation. Mm. Sort of at midnight, you know, until 2 a.m, just bashing them out on the keyboard. Mm. But I think in a way, because it was the food that we cooked at the restaurant for the most part, I could do that. I could go, okay, I haven't got much time and I'm quite tired, but I do know what I'm talking about because we've cooked it loads of times. Or you know, some of the book is about particular meals that we cooked, like one-off set menus. And it's kind of the story of how the night went. You know, if the recipe worked well, I'd say it worked well. And sometimes they were bad and I go, look, we made it like this, but to be honest, I'd put this in next time. But it's kind of more obvious. But yeah, the new book is took me a lot longer because it was food that, you know, I was researching things that I'd never heard of before. And you know, I hadn't necessarily traveled to the region where that dish was from. So it was a lot of reading and it took me a lot longer.
You seem to have a very adventurous approach to food where you kind of just want to kind of learn about it and then sort of start to cook it. Are there any kind of new regions that you're looking at that you're sort of interested in?
To be honest, after writing this book, I'm quite excited to think about writing about food that's not from France. It's a funny one because I found that the more that I delved into it, that, you know, I realised that the less I knew. It's sort of, well, the more I knew, but that I realised that there was so much more to learn and that I would never really do more than scratch the surface. It's so rich, all the regions of France are so rich and the cooking is so involved and the history is so amazing, that I realised that, like, I'm never going to be an expert on all of them. It would take more than one lifetime. But I was just interested to find out a few things that I'd never heard of before, you know, and hopefully that enthusiasm comes across in the book. You know, I don't claim to be an expert at any point, I think. But I was just excited to learn about new things of, you know, regions that I knew. Provence, for example, I've been cooking, you know, Provençal food for years. And there's loads of stuff that I'd never heard of that I wanted to sort of put out there and, you know, share the love.
The new book focuses specifically on food from borderlands. Was it simply this lack of knowledge that you had that led you to that? Because it is a very sprawling topic, as you say, more than one lifetime's worth of knowledge and expertise. What attracted you to that as a topic?
I think what interested me most about the idea of borderlands is that there's crossover over the borders. I was really interested in the idea that French food, you know, as codified as it's become, and as well known as it is, and as famous as it is across the world, wasn't always French, you know, because the borders have changed and ideas have come from across what is the modern border. And that was interesting for me. And I think I first came to that, to play with that idea when I was cooking at Sardine and I was cooking Northern Italian food and noticed the similarities with Provençal food. You know, it's just sort of 20 miles away kind of thing. And I was kind of cooking Italian food and changing one ingredient or changing the wording on the menu, and suddenly it feels really French. And that was what I found interesting, and that's what I wanted to explore. And I think it's quite a neat way of doing it by looking at the physical regions which are around the outside. It's also sort of some really interesting recipes from those areas, but it's also, like, moreover, a showcase of this is where French food has come from, and these are the similarities that you find on both sides of the border. And I think that's quite interesting at the moment, you know, where there's lots of talk about closing borders and, you know, it's quite complicated politics, and I won't get into that. But
try and avoid that on this podcast. Yeah, as much exactly. as possible.
But, you know, it's just to show that food and cookery has always been across the borders and will continue to be. Yeah. And I think that's really important to remember.
And Sardine sadly closed in 2020, and you now work as the head chef at Noble Rot in Soho. Can you take us through that period and how you made that transition?
Yeah, I was talking about this recently, and I sort of had forgotten how stressful it was.
Was it the pandemic?
It was the pandemic, yeah. So, you know, we found out in whenever it was that, you know, when you start hearing about the pandemic and suddenly people start coming to the restaurant, it's sort of the first thing that happens is people don't go to restaurants anymore. Yeah. Sort of obvious plague pit. And we were sitting there thinking, wow, we're quiet, and thinking, wow, this is going to go badly. And then there was the really weird thing on, you know, it was announced on Monday that people shouldn't go to restaurants, but restaurants weren't closed. So we sat there for a week in this empty restaurant thinking, like, oh, we're going to have to find something else to do. Yeah, it was really stressful. We ended up closing. You know, there was all the stress of, like, trying to get all the staff on furlough and everything. That, yeah, it was very stressful for me. And for a lot of people. And then when it came to sort of halfway through the lockdown, we were kind of just kind of thinking about maybe we should do some kind of like takeaway delivery business. And I just thought, like, no one wants bouillabaisse in a box. Like, let's just close. And my investor, you know, he agreed. It was a little neighborhood restaurant, you know, that was never going to make anyone any millions. But it was, you know, it was for the people who live around there. And when we decided to close, it was definitely the best idea. But it was very sweet. I had hundreds of emails from people, like some people who I'd never met before, some people who'd only been once, and, you know, also loads of regulars. And it was quite an emotional time. I kind of, you know, it was for the best in the end, and we had a pretty good run. We did 4 years, and pandemic's quite a neat way of getting out of a business venture.
Yeah. And then what was the route then into Noble Rot? Did you know
I got
kind of Noble Rot gang before?
No, I'd been to Noble Rot and sort of admired it from afar. And they were the competition, and they were very good. No, I loved Noble Rot, but I got an email from Marina O'Loughlin, who's one of the investors, and she said, "What are you doing?" You know, she heard that I was out of a job, and she got in touch and said, "Would you like to meet Dan and Mark?" And went from there. And I didn't quite realise that they were going to offer me the job at the new restaurant, but that was how. That was how the cookie crumbled. And actually, I was really excited to do that. It was a new space to cook in, and I'd have to find a slightly new focus of the food. You know, and the brief was great. It was like, just cook food that's good with wine, which is almost everything, apart from soup. I don't cook soup, which I am slightly still upset about that. But it's okay. There's plenty of other things to cook. Soup isn't that good with wine, you see. I don't completely agree. I'm sure if Dan and Mark are listening, then they'll forgive me. It's great. They're a great company to work for. They're all fantastic people. And I love the other restaurants. And I love the restaurant that we built in Soho. You know, it's an amazing old building. It used to be the Gay Hussar, which is a Hungarian restaurant that was there for 60 years. Plenty of stories about, you know, political meetings and, you know.
Do you still get political types coming in, or is it a different crowd these days?
Not so much. It's, you know, it's Soho. It's pre-theatre. It's kind of funny. Like, the other Noble Rots are maybe more focused on wine, but we're in Soho and people sort of see it as more of a restaurant, I think. just happens to have one of the best wine lists in the city. Mm. I'm really happy to work there. I'm really proud to work with them. And I love all the Noble Ruts, but, you know, soft spot for Soho always, I think.
And when you're not chefing, where do you like to eat in London?
Oh, Boucheron Racine is the first one that comes to mind. Well, Henry Harris cooking is fantastic. I'm sure you guys have been.
That's brilliant.
And I remember going to Racine years and years ago when I was a young cook working at Dock Kitchen. And I went with a few friends and we spent like £45 on sparkling water by mistake. You know, the waiters are very charming and they wear lovely suits and the bubbles were very small. And they come over and say, another water, sir? And you're like, of course. It felt very glamorous. And Harry came and gave us a plate of saucisson. We spent a fortune. But yeah, his cooking is fantastic. And I love Racine. It feels quite a sort of, it feels like quite a special place. Mm. It's quite intimate. But I love that kind of food. It's really simple, really. I mean, some of it's quite technically complicated, but he kind of hides it. Mm. And that's the kind of, I don't know, I think that what I like the most about that kind of cooking, it's something I aspire to cook at the restaurant, is it's really honest. And above all, it's really satisfying. I was talking about this recently. I think that a lot of cooks, especially chefs, I mean, chefs are really, there's some real ones. They forget that food should be satisfying, you know, and they cook. There's a lot of ego in it. I mean, this is like massive. I'm delving into, you know, going really into stereotypes here. But they forget that food should be honest and satisfying. And it's nice to get stuck into something. And I think when you go to Racine, that's the kind of food that you get.
It's a great restaurant. It feels quite similar to Noble Rot, I'd say, in a way. Mm. And Alex, when you're not in restaurants, either as a chef or dining out, what do you like to cook when you're at home?
Like something completely different, to be honest. I bought myself a wok for Christmas, so I'm cooking a lot of like Sichuan food. I really like cooking Indian food. Before I came here, I was in Bethnal Green, and then I walked to Whitechapel and bought some spices. It's something that I used to do at work all the time, and now I don't get the chance to do it anymore. I bought some black cumin and some Kashmiri chili. I couldn't find any black cardamom, but like that's the kind of thing that I used to do on my day off a lot. I love cooking Indian food. We used to cook a lot of Southern Indian and Sri Lankan food at Dock Kitchen. But really, I'm sort of quite obsessed with it, is like biryani and pulao and pilaf and meat cooked with rice. It's a really delicate spicing sometimes. It's that kind of thing that I really love to cook at home. It's quite rare that I do sort of fine French dining at home. It's not really my bag.
Not during the day.
No, exactly.
Is that love of Indian food informed by travelling? Or again, is this something you've taught yourself from cookbooks and reading?
I think really it's growing up in Birmingham, we used to eat a lot of curry, you know. And it's not, to be honest, the food that I've had in London is a bit more, you know, Birmingham, and, you know, I don't think the best Indian restaurants in the UK have been in Birmingham, the ones that I've eaten at. But we used to have it a lot. We used to, you know, it was like every week we'd go out for curry. And so we grew up with a lot of spices, and, you know, I didn't travel to that bit of the world until I was much older. But growing up eating that kind of food, we were kind of used to it. And then after I moved to London, the restaurants are really sort of, you know, all that, it's kind of a lot of Pakistani food and, you know, sort of like Lahore Kebab House and Thai Abs and stuff. Going there for the first time, I was like, wow. You know, and I'm sure that, you know, there are plenty of other restaurants available. But I remember going to those for the first time and thinking, wow, this is really exciting. But yeah, it comes from, you know, growing up, we used to eat it. And then when I worked at Dock Kitchen, it was one of Stevie's real interests. Like, he loved Indian food and he loved Southern Indian food in particular. And you come to realize that it can be really delicate and really nuanced. And, you know, he would talk about it as Indian food is, you know, one of the greatest cuisines of the world. I completely subscribe to that. It's so complicated. And there's so much variation. There's a lot to, you know, you can get lost in it.
And perhaps the answer to this question is curry. But what for you is comfort food? What would you cook if you just got home and just needed something?
That's exactly it. Like, I'll tell you exactly what I would cook, because I cook it all the time. And like with varying success for some reason. It's because it's quite hard, I think. I cook chicken and rice together. So I don't know what to call it. Pulao, maybe. I cook, chicken with spices and onions and garlic and ginger. And then sometimes some tomato. And then I soak rice, put it on top, and I put water and I cook it. So it's kind of not layered, but it's like a biryani. And I boil potatoes and turmeric, and then I fry them for crispy sprinkles. You always need the crispy sprinkle plate, coriander, julienne, ginger, turmeric, fried potatoes, boiled egg. Mm-hmm. Other sprinkles are available. I cook it all the time, and often, like, if I'm cooking it on my own, that's what I want to make. I was end up making way too much, but and it's I love cooking that kind of food, and my brother as well cooks a lot of that kind of food. Like, he's not a restaurant chef, but he works in food and he's an amazing cook. And he cooks, I'm kind of jealous of him actually, because while I'm spending all my time doing all this French food, he gets to cook all this exciting, like, loads of spices and from all around the world, and he's really knowledgeable. And on occasion, like, cooking stuff with him, like, we got into a tradition at Christmas Eve. I'd cook pheasant biryani, and I wasn't there this Christmas, but he cooked it, and I was like, I wanted to be there. You know? It's nice to explore it together with him.
Must be.
And do you have a sweet tooth at all? Do you make puddings at home?
I never make pudding at home. I don't really have the time. I mean, I know there are quick puddings, but I guess my tooth isn't sweet enough. But I want to make tart when it's like a special occasion, I'll make a tart. And the apricot and brown butter one that was in Sardine Book is one that I go back to again and again and again. And then something we had on the menu at Noble Rot recently, it's just, it's like pear and hazelnut and rosemary tart. It's like a hazelnut frangipane that my old sous chef at Sardine taught me. Yeah, delicious. That's the kind of thing I want to eat. If I'm going to eat any dessert, it'll be a tart and like a massive pile of creme fraiche with it. That's what I'd like.
Now, Alex, we normally always finish this podcast with the same question, which is, what would be your desert island meal? What would be your kind of ultimate meal?
Is it possible for it to be like really loads of courses? Or do I have to just pick one?
Yeah, as many courses. Yes, people come up with quite unusual answers to this question. So whatever you fancy.
Yeah, well, if it's not going to be chicken pulao, I think that someone else asked me this. They were like, what would your like last ever meal be? And I was just like, oh, it'd be the scope of it would be very grand. But I think I had a meal in Sicily quite recently, like early last year, that was like a succession of very simple seafood. And that kind of thing, I think, really interested in eating again and again and again. And I think if you're on a desert island, then there's probably quite a lot of nice fish. There's, we went and it was just like a massive plate of crudo, like raw fish, but like three different types of prawns, four different types of fish roe, everything raw. And this very sweet American couple were like, can you eat this? And I remember the waiter trying not to laugh. But yeah, they have the crudo and then you have like eight courses of cooked things, but it's all super, super simple. And then if you're still hungry, you can have the pasta. I remember spaghetti with clams and bataga. And if you're still hungry after that, you can have roast fish. So I think that's the answer. It's roast fish, like a huge one to share. Or if it's just me on the island, I have the whole one myself. You know, olive oil, tomatoes, herbs, maybe a bit of white wine. I'd also need some wine on the island, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Would you have pudding?
A bit hot for cheese, isn't it?
Cheese.
No, I think fruit. Yeah, some fruit. What kind of island is it? Where is it?
Well, I mean, when we say island, I mean, we also kind of do it as a death row one. You can have whatever you want on this island.
No, I'd have some fruit. If it were tropical island, I'd have tropical fruit. If not, it'd be spring, and I'd have some Garriguet strawberries. So, that, you know, they're like the first strawberries that you get coming out of winter, those really expensive Provençal ones. I'd have those. Delicious. Maybe some whipped cream in them.
Yum. Well, Alex, thank you for joining Table Talk. And Alex Jackson's new book, Frontier, is available now.